Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be looking back at the influence of the French New Wave as we meet Sir Christopher Frayling and Tony Normand.
Then we'll be discussing the potential of digital exhibition spaces as we catch up with the Chisenhale Gallery's new director, Zoe Whitley.
And we'll be walking the fine line between music and art as we meet Borealis Festival director, Peter Mingwell.
That's all coming up, and we've got some great music too for you, of course, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again then, Fernando, challenging times and people around the world at home. Listen, things aren't great, but it does drive people to find new cultural offerings. And maybe we can at least help nudge people in the right direction in terms of some things that they can watch, see, listen to, that might add a little bit of much-needed sunshine.
Well, it is much-needed, Tom, as you say, and I think, you know, all the industries, from the film industries to art, as we're going to see in the show, you know, you can see some exhibitions online. Universal, for example, they're releasing some films that has just been released to cinema to on demand. So I think companies are understanding they were unprecedented times. So I'm definitely been catching up with, you know, lots of films, music, you know, especially music. I think so important. I mean, you have to go to your favorites and there's so much out there. And if you think about it, Tom, this just comes to my mind. I mean, there's a lot of artists, you know, with, you know, upcoming albums. I mean, that can still happen because most people listen via streaming anyway. And the music industry is going through some tough times. So perhaps it's time to support your favorite artists.
Well, this is it. So initially, obviously, the picture for, you know, across the whole cultural space at first glance seems incredibly challenging. But there are opportunities there. And interestingly, I suppose, whether you're a visual artist, whether you work in music or in literature, a lot of great minds are here and a lot of innovation. People in this space are often early adopters. They're quicker to find pathways of opportunity. So we can cling on to those positive stories. And as you said, you know, people need a soundtrack. We hope that we are doing our bit at Monocle 24, but I think we've got some more tips for them, haven't we, today?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I mean, we're going to play a song now, Tom. I reviewed his latest album in the new issue of the magazine, his Thundercat. I mean, he's excellent. One of the first singles of his new album is called Dragon Ball Durag. And you know why is it called? Because, you know, he loves Dragon Ball Z. So it was kind of an homage. And I love his music. It's quite yacht pop, meets soul. It's a good soundtrack for our times. Shall we have a listen?
Let's listen to it, Faye. That was Dragon Ball Durag by Thundercat. Nice selection, Fernando. In a moment, we'll be flicking through a new book exploring the posters of the French New Wave. Stay tuned. From 1959, a group of young French directors, the likes of Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut, pioneered a new mode of cinema through their experimental low-budget films.
Their artistic irreverence revolutionized moviegoing all over the world. It also revolutionized the design of the movie poster. Louis Harnett O'Meara speaks to cultural historian Sir Christopher Frayling and the editor and publisher Tony Normand about their new book, French New Wave, A Revolution in Design.
I want to know what the French New Wave is. So who are these filmmakers that have come out of France and what's their message and where did they come from?
Well, the French New Wave was a phrase coined in 1957, but it really came to fruition in 1959, Cannes Film Festival, where a bunch of young filmmakers who'd been critics on a French journal called Cahiers du Cinéma, Notebooks of Cinema, which began in the early 1950s, came up with a whole new way of making movies. Mobile cameras, lightweight cameras, in the street, improvised dialogue. You cast all your friends for the interiors, you shoot them in your friends' apartments. And there was this kind of small-scale loosening up of cinema. They adored Hollywood, but they wanted to find a different way of doing it. They also wanted to find a different way to traditional French cinema, which they called the cinéma de papa. And cinéma de papa was overlit, heritage, static, made in the studios, good taste, you know, sort of heritage cinema. And they absolutely thought that was the death of cinema. So let's loosen it up. Let's shoot on the streets. And at the time, it was treated as revolutionary. Of course, 5 years later, Hollywood was watching And suddenly it starts having a huge effect on the way Hollywood movies are made, which also loosen up, which also move out on location, and which also stop being so studio-bound and overlit. So it really had a profound effect on world cinema, eventually.
And was this a defined group, or was it just a kind of general feeling that came out of...
Well, there was a core group, Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut, Claude Chabrol, Jacques Rivette, all of whom knew each other as critics on Cahiers du Cinéma, and then there was a broader bunch of people who picked up on the language, some of them much older, because these were young, it was a very youthful movement, and some of the older filmmakers, René Clément, Georges Franju, and people like that, were watching what was going on, and it affected the way they made films as well. But the core of it was these youngsters who cut their teeth by writing about Hollywood. But unlike most film critics, they said, we want to make films rather than just write about them all the time and show what we believe in. And they invented this thing called the auteur theory, which is the author theory. In other words, the important thing about a movie is not the star, which was the thing in Hollywood, not the producer, it's the director. And on the analogy of literature, you have an author for a film. It's the product of a single intelligence, so the director, and they wanted to be that director. So they make movies where, if you look at the posters, which are the subject of this book, the director's name is in huge letters when it's featured at all, and the star is hardly mentioned. The star of these films is the director, and he moulds the performances to his or her image. There were one or two hers. Agnès Varda, who died recently, was one of them. So this is authored cinema, whereas they thought that a lot of Hollywood cinema was assembly line cinema, made by an industry in factories where actually the star system is what dominated. So that was part of it as well. We want to be authors.
You say they were writers. So to what extent was it a theoretical movement? To what extent was it practical? How much were people out there doing it?
It started off as theoretical, but they wrote as wannabe practitioners. They didn't write as professional movie critics. Everything they wrote was saying, I could do better. Just give me a chance. And what's interesting is that, you know, having researched this, that the government in France, under the great culture minister André Malraux, didn't give them any money at all. I assume they all got grants to do this, which would be the case with the sort of Arts Council in England. Instead, these were maverick producers who thought, oh, these youngsters might have something that's worth investing in. And there were a bunch of maverick producers who put money into Jean-Luc Godard's films or Truffaut's films, which did very well, actually, at the box office when it turned out. So, yeah, they were practitioners in waiting rather than professional movie critics. And they write some... Cahiers du Cinéma is full of heroes, so they have a sort of pantheon of filmmakers. Hitchcock couldn't do any wrong. Nicholas Ray couldn't do any wrong. Bud Bettiker, Sam Fuller, not the mainstream people who made epic big-budget films, but the slightly maverick Hollywood. Orson Welles, people on the edges. B-movies meant B for better, you know. The smaller the budget, the more that necessity was the mother of invention, and you're liable to get much more exciting films in low-budget land. So they had these heroes, and you find complete madness, like a Hollywood director is compared with Beethoven or compared with Stendhal or Charles Dickens. I mean, they were really overdoing it, saying, these are my heroes, but give me a chance and I'll make a movie as well.
So you get this kind of creative energy, I suppose, and that is translating onto the screen and it's translating into their writing. But I suppose what this book is looking at is the way that French New Wave was a revolution in design. So the way that it changed the world of movie posters. And I'd just like to speak to Tony about how that energy transferred and the ways in which it manifested itself in these posters.
By the mid-50s, late-50s, a lot of the Hollywood movie posters had become very traditional in the way that, for example, Saul Bass did a poster for Man with a Golden Arm, which was just the arm with these blue blocks of colour on it, which was used for the premiere of the film. But the studios removed it immediately after the premiere, and they insisted to have Frank Sinatra's face superimposed on it because they paid a lot of money to get Frank Sinatra in the movie. So they were being bastardized, if you like, for the wrong reasons. With the French New Wave, you know, I started realizing that they were all different when I used to be a movie poster dealer and I used to do books on movie posters. Whereas photomontage was, you know, in the case of Man with the Golden Arm, literally the studio had taken the faces of Frank Sinatra and whoever else was in the movie and stuck them on top of the artwork. Whereas something like Breathless, the French poster for Breathless, is a photomontage which is slightly different because it's also images stuck with artwork, but it's all thought out.
And it's not just the pictures, is it? I mean, the thing about Hollywood posters were the size of the typography depended on contractual obligations. So if you're the main star, you get the biggest letters. And they measure it to the millimetre of exactly what you're entitled to in relation to the others. So you're not learning much about the movie. You're learning about how much money they paid to get the stars in and all the rest of it. And very often the producer's name is in huge letters because that's the money person. And the director is sometimes in smaller letters on the traditional Hollywood poster. So just as they went for Le Cinéma de Papa, they went for Les Affiches de Papa, you know, father's posters. And that sort of traditional language didn't appeal to them.
But also another thing you have to remember, which the younger generation now just don't realise, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, right up to the invention of video cassettes, the movie posters were the main way that people would find out what's showing at their local cinema. So it would be a matter of seeing something, and that image as you're walking past it would entice you to, you know, go to the local cinema, put your hand in your pocket, buy a ticket and go into the cinema. But when video cassettes came in, they started advertising the movies that were going to come out. When you used to rent a video cassette, it was on there. Then it happened with DVDs. And now you hear about movies coming out 4 or 5 months before they even are announced. If you're on the internet, whatever you look at, you get news. So people don't spend time thinking or paying any attention to movie posters because they don't serve that strong purpose the way they used to.
Plus, these days, the campaigns, these digital campaigns, tend to be global. So you simply customize them to local traditions a little bit. It's the same campaign all over the world, whereas there was a strong tradition in the 50s and 60s of each European country having its own style of posters, which don't resemble the Hollywood ones at all. Already before the French New Wave, you know, you can tell a French movie poster, an Italian movie poster. There's a kind of style that emerges.
That sort of stopped with Jaws. That's the first movie that I can remember where that image of the shark going up towards the woman swimming was used as the basis for movie posters in Japan, in France, in Germany, all over the world, you know. The other thing is with the movie posters, they were also designed by young artists who had the freedom, because they were working for independence, to design things that would normally not be allowed in a big Hollywood system. And that's where I think all the creativity comes from, because they didn't have much money, but they had freedom. So it's, what can I do with this amount of money and this amount of space on a piece of paper to advertise this movie?
Sure. And there's enormous diversity in the book as well. I mean, you look at it and there's... it goes from watercolours to, I don't know, collage, and it goes from one end of the planet to the other as well. There's movie posters from Japan in here, and then obviously in France and then America, and the way that each different nation responded is very distinctive.
Yeah, and very strong in Eastern Europe. A lot of East Germany, Romania, all the Eastern European countries.
You can also tell a lot about the psyche of the different people living in the different countries, you know. I always mention this thing about the movie Asphalt Jungle by John Huston in 1950.
Mr. Emick wouldn't commit a crime.
He would and did.
Is a heist movie, and Marilyn Monroe has a four-minute role in it. But when she became famous, they reissued this film in Italy.
What I said yesterday was...
And the entire movie poster is a giant painting of Marilyn Monroe wearing a sexy dress, even though she has nothing to do with the movie.
It wasn't really the...
Was it the truth? You went with Emmerich, were you?
No, sir.
He was someplace else and you were not with him.
So it tells you about what would get the Italians to go to the cinema.
And what impact do you think the posters have had on design since then?
They picked up on various things that were in the avant-garde in graphic design at the time. Experiments in typography, typography being part of the overall design rather than taking ready-made alphabets. You actually customise the alphabet to fit the overall design. Not having star picks, but using photomontage or cut paper or all these things that were kind of tricks that were in the ether where graphic design was concerned. And I think these posters sort of accelerated the acceptance of that kind of visual language of graphics. They didn't invent it necessarily, but no one had dared put them on movie posters before. And it's quite interesting. You have to ask with some of them, what on earth were they advertising? There's one film called Hiroshima Mon Amour, and there's another for a film called The Little Soldier, and they are completely abstract, these images. They've picked up on the latest developments in fine art, which you'd never get in Hollywood. And you've got an abstract image, one of which looks like a Jackson Pollock and one of which looks like a Francis Bacon, and you say, what the hell's that got to do with the movie? But more than that, if you saw that on a tube, what would it tell you? Well, it kind of draws attention to itself as avant-garde, that whatever this movie is, it's going to be interesting and avant-garde and exciting, and that's basically what it's putting over. Weekend by Jean-Luc Godard is about a traffic jam that goes completely wrong and ends up with cannibalism. Spoiler alert. But the poster is diagonally across the middle. You've got Weekend, which is the title. The middle of it is smudged, so it looks like the windscreen wiper on a car. Well, you know, you get that smudging, and sometimes, you know, things aren't in focus when you look through the windscreen of the car. So you've got that idea of looking through the windscreen of the car, and then you look at the information. It's in tiny letters. The most important thing about it is that it's Jean-Luc Godard is in the biggest letters, the director. But it's such a clever idea. You know, it's distilled it to this one image of the title, and then the typography actually tells the story. No reference to the stars, no star pics, no, you know, percentage sizes, none of that. It's just a graphic image, and you see that and you think, yeah, that'd be an interesting film. It's about a weekend, but it doesn't tell you anything about cars, it doesn't tell you about traffic jams, or it certainly doesn't tell you about cannibalism, but it sort of distills the point of the movie.
And it looks great.
It looks fantastic. Yeah. It really does. Another favourite thing that Tony found out in his research is there was a West German company called Constantin, which was based in Frankfurt, which is a distribution company. And they went one better. They produce posters where one side of the poster is arty and the other side of the poster is very, very traditional. And they'd send it to all these places in Germany so the local cinema manager could decide, are they going to respond to the arty image or are they going to respond to the traditional image? And you choose which side you want to put in the cinema. I love that idea.
Yeah, but it was very expensive, wasn't it?
It was expensive. It didn't last very long, but it's clever. Backing both horses.
It lasted for 2 years.
But backing both horses, it's nice.
You know, when you open this book virtually to any page at random, it's amazing how modern these works still look. I mean, if you saw these designs in a book by a graphic designer that's working now, they seem like they're on the money. You know, whether it's a Japanese movie poster or an Italian design, I mean, they have a very, very, they have not aged at all. You know, when you look at a film noir movie poster, you can appreciate it and it looks great, but it also looks like it's from a specific time.
Of its period, very much.
Of its period. But when you open this up, literally, I think
designers
today would be
Norman
proud if they designed most of these posters, because they're just, they look timeless.
Thanks to Sir Christopher Frayling and Tony Norman speaking to Monocle's Louis Harnett O'Mara. And French New Wave, a revolution in design, is out now. London's Chisenhale Gallery is a cultural institution. Over its 37-year history, it's built up a reputation for innovation through its singular practice of working with artists on commissions, assisting with production before exhibiting new works.
Its incoming director is Zoe Whitley, arriving from her post as senior curator at the Hayward Gallery. She's stepping into her new role this month. Monocle's Augustine Macellari caught up with her earlier to learn more about her plans for the gallery and how, as galleries go on hiatus, digital exhibitions offer a new way for people to consume art.
Zoe started by unpacking what the Chisenhale means to London's artistic community.
I think that Chisenhale's community is really made by artists and for artists. It's something that Polly Staple and, you know, other team members and my forebears have discussed at length. And it even came up not that long ago when Anthea Hamilton did one of her best of the year recaps and was talking about like what it meant to feel a particular way in Emma Abbasi Okon's exhibition. And so there's something really wonderful about Chisenhale being such an important and consistent port of call for artists to support other artists. That's something that's been incredibly meaningful for me in terms of witnessing it. And then, like any gallery that would be proud of its prescient past, it's also the site where so many artists that have become household names in contemporary art, you know, well, if there is such a thing, have had their really breakthrough moments. Lynette Yadambwachi, to name but one, But equally, the very first show that I saw there in 2003 was Faisal Abdullah working in collaboration with a young architect named David Adjaye. So there's a momentum and a history there of what it meant for Chisholm Hill to invest in an artist at a pivotal moment in their careers. And I think one of the legacies of certainly the 1990s is typically that pivotal moment tended to come relatively early in an artist's career. So it's a kind of a younger artist with promise. And I think that certainly as we move forward, there's scope for us to think about the long arc of being an artist, and that pivotal moments in an artist's career may come decades later, or it may be that they've taught successive generations of artists who we know better, but we are not as familiar with their practices. So I think there's scope to honor the mission while expanding it in some ways that are really true to what Chisholm Hill has always been about.
That's a really interesting thing to pick up. You know, the Turner Prize also kind of fairly recently, didn't it, relaxed its policy on having an upper limit on the age of the artist who could win. What's the like romance of the young artist then versus the kind of the older or the later career artist? There've been some amazing exhibitions recently. I was just thinking of that Rose Wiley that I went to see maybe a year or two ago at the Serpentine. There's kind of, do you think, are people a bit more awake to, as you say, these old artists who have enjoyed influential roles or who've had these amazing careers but maybe haven't had quite the recognition?
I think it's probably a bigger picture than that. And it probably has a lot to do with the ways in which we, as a sector, tend to categorize. So whether someone is emerging and people end up being able to, in one way or another, brag about the kudos of having seen someone first or you knew them when. And then there's this kind of slightly more amorphous mid-career, and then, you know, what we think of as established. And I think within the curatorial sector, the two poles that have been kind of most highly saturated in terms of media interest, in terms of institutional interest, have likely been those kind of, that initial moment of discovery, of someone recognizing some kind of spark of greatness and originality and, you know, maybe something even slightly unspoken in a young artist. And then, you know, as you mentioned, that on the other end of the spectrum, I think that there is, I think very rightly, a recommitment in art history and in curatorial practice to address lacunae in the canon and to think about whose voices haven't been heard. And so then on the other end of the spectrum, that has, to a certain extent, involved a process of kind of recuperating certain artists who might be octogenarians or even nonagenarians, but, you know, that long road in the middle is something that perhaps doesn't strike many people as sexy, but, you know, that is the life of an artist. Phyllida Barlow has talked a lot about that, about the different kinds of success, of youth success and the kind of wild, unimaginable success. And then she says there's the success of keeping going through hell and high water. And I think the more that we, as a sector, can find ways to champion that as well. And it's not easy because there are always selections and processes and decisions being made. You're doing this and not that. But for us to think about that wide middle and not just that kind of first flash of creativity or potentially heroic moment toward the end of someone's long career are things that are worth thinking about. You know, it's always worth looking at, okay, where are these spotlights landing? And where, as a result of that, could artists benefit from a little more shine? And so the more we think about that, I think some really exciting things will come from it.
I was just having a look earlier at the Chisholm Hill Gallery's kind of About Me website, and it describes the gallery as a production agency, an exhibition hall, a research centre and a community resource. Those four different things seem like a kind of very exciting set to be conflated, to be at the head of. Does the Chisenhale kind of, is it quite a unique gallery in the kind of in the public purse, I suppose?
Partly what attracted me to the role was that it definitely occupies a unique place within London's cultural landscape, not least because it is commissioning work. So if you think of the high profile opportunities for artists to have their work within a public realm in the UK, or certainly within London, there's the Fourth Plinth, which, you know, of course, is international. You know, the Turbine Hall also comes to mind at Tate Modern, or the Duveen Galleries at Tate Britain. They're really wonderful and visionary commissioning agencies like Art Angel, but at a kind of smaller scale, but still significant. You know, those opportunities tend to be few and far between. So to be able to work with artists, and that was one of the things that I enjoyed so much about talking to Ellie Gregg, our curator. One of the first things she said to me was, we rarely say no to artists. So once you've made a commitment to work with an artist, you know, you're starting from a point of why not? Not why should we do this? Why? No, no. You're starting from a like, yes, let's try it. Let's see how we can do this. And that way of thinking through an institutional way of being that's completely committed to enabling and supporting and providing that critical friendship is something that artists really appreciate. And it's partly why Chisenhale enjoys the reputation that it does and why it's an organization that I want to help kind of sustain the fantastic momentum that it's already established.
You know, obviously we're talking in mid-March 2020. There's a kind of, there's this ongoing crisis that's sort of, that's really affecting all corners of the world. In the art world, there's been a kind of a quite interesting response. You know, organizations like Art Basel, lots of galleries, you know, Japan Fashion Week, all of these different kind of cultural institutions have made a bid to pivot to digital spaces. You know, there's this idea that art needs to, or culture kind of can continue even in the absence of a live kind of iteration. How does that kind of, you know, given that you have this amazing remit at the Chisenhale to commission work, how does that kind of, that longer view, because I think people have been talking about digital space for a long time, but this seems like maybe the first time that beyond the Hans Ulrich Obrists of the world, beyond the people who get really excited about these things, that maybe more mainstream audiences might actually start to engage with these spaces and actually start to use them for their culture, simply because of the impossibility of getting into galleries or museums for the foreseeable future. How is that going to play into your operations at Chisenhale, do you think?
Well, I think, like with everything else, we're going to be taking the lead from artists. I mean, one of the Chisenhale alumnus is Lawrence Abuhamdan. And a couple of days ago on Instagram, he posted that, you know, in recognition of his moving image and sound works that wouldn't be able to be seen or more crucially heard in these next months because of gallery closures worldwide, he was going to make the content that he's created freely accessible on his website. And as a result of seeing that, other artists who I know, like South African artist Mikhail Subotsky, has followed suit and kind of tagged other people in turn. A filmmaker who I have great respect for in the US, Colleen Smith, has done the same thing. So I think that there are ways in which being able to access artist works without having to know them personally or having access to, you know, a password-protected Vimeo. And for those of us who are in our homes and might be watching something on a screen larger than our phones and, you know, can link it up to a larger television set or something like that. I think those are possibilities that no longer seem like add-ons. I think for a long time, the digital space was a sort of an appendage to the main attraction, which was the exhibition space and the live gathering and seeing something in the real. I think the more that contemporary artists in particular have kind of dematerialized the object and are creating different ways of thinking about how we come together and how we're being, then this way of thinking about the digital as a really productive discursive space is something that can continue to happen. I mean, in a more kind of lighthearted note, I really love Bedra Williams' Instagram account because he uses not only the images, which I think are iPad drawings, but also the comments sections. So he ends up kind of replying to himself in all of these different voices and is able to capture a certain kind of smugness and self-congratulatoriness of the art world that is absolutely hilarious and really, really like laser sharp and really focused and accurate. So I think that, like everyone else, it's something that we're increasingly taking seriously. So people who were exhibition makers and thinking about a kind of physical space and how you draw people there are now thinking more about things like, you know, trailers to exhibitions, exhibitions that exist online, you know, things that texts that you download or that you access through your phone. I know one of Phoebe Boswell's exhibitions included QR codes embedded in her drawings so that you'd be accessing content that each of her sitters that she painstakingly draws wanted to direct you to. So there are all these different ways of thinking about levels of engagement. And so again, by, you know, in a pretty straightforward way, kind of looking at where artists are leading us, I think that we can begin to innovate beyond the kind of accepted modes of receiving and displaying artworks.
Thanks to Zoe Wheatley talking to Monaco's Augustine Macellari. And to stay on top of what's happening in the gallery, which is temporarily closed, do keep an eye on its digital channels. There'll be plenty going on. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. Shall we have another song, Tom?
Fernando, I am in the mood for music. What have you got for me this time?
Well, we're going disco now. This is the new single by Rushing Murphy, Murphy's Law.
That was Murphy's Law by Rasheen Murphy. And Fernando, eagle-eyed listeners will recall that Rasheen was a guest on this very programme, I think, perhaps last year. Lots of fun chatting with Rasheen. People should delve into our archives and have a listen to that interview.
She was talking about her Italo Disco album, which is excellent, by the way. That's another one you can stream on if you're at home.
Fernando, you're a fount of positive vibes today, which I, and I'm sure our listeners around the world, appreciate. This is the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24.
At the beginning of March, Monaco's Nora Hull went along to Borealis, an experimental music festival in Bergen, Norway. A celebration of boundary hopping, it showcases music and art, and a blend between the two.
Last year's Venice Biennale Golden Lion winner, Sun and the Sea, was performed this year alongside a host of workshop and performances with other luminaries from the field of experimental music.
Alongside the physical festival, Borealis has also been broadcasting online on its radio space and will do for the rest of March. Nora caught up with the festival's artistic director, Peter Meanwell, to learn more.
Borealis is a festival for experimental music that happens every year in Bergen in Norway on the west coast where it rains a lot. The festival is it's called a festival for experimental music because that was the loosest way we could come up with to describe a festival that's about composers, musicians, artists that are pushing at the boundaries of their genre using sound and music, but also about thinking about how we listen and what it means to kind of be listening bodies in spaces. So it's kind of a broad term. But the idea is that we bring together a lot of people who are kind of exploring, who are trying out new things, and give a platform for them to happen across the city over 5 days. Around 300,000 people live in the wider Bergen city area, and then it has this tiny centre. I think there's like 20,000 people who live in the centre, and it's an old 15th century city. It was part of the Hanseatic League. And then it's surrounded by seven mountains. So it's really like you couldn't get more weirdly enclosed. But then it looks out into the fjord and then out to the North Sea and across the Atlantic. So it's a kind of an interesting position for a city to be in. And Norway is peculiar, I should say, in its kind of financial and political situation. It has a sovereign wealth fund because of the North Sea oil. And a lot of that money is used to invest in culture, which means that Norwegians have a very good access to culture from a very young age. Culture is well funded here from a state level, which means that the community in Bergen are kind of really into culture. So when you rock up and say, hey, we're going to do something that maybe you don't know, you're not starting from zero, right? Because everyone's had this amazing cultural education and there's stuff going on all the time. So you come in and go like, we're a bit weirder than most. And people are like, yeah, okay, we'll give you a try. So in some ways, there's this kind of, it's a really advantageous place to be in because you're in the small town, you can get people's attention. But like making a community is really important.
Yeah, and in regards to the community aspect, you have your listening clubs that run throughout the year. You do an artist in residence. You have a young composer scheme. It seems that you are quite actively working to engage the community as well.
I mean, I think one of the advantages of a big city is that whatever niche music you present, there's probably enough people to fill a club, right? So you say, okay, we're doing kind of noise music tonight, and there's probably enough people that you can have a scene. In a small city, that's harder. That scene might be 4 people, you know, 10 people or whatever. So I think when we started, we wanted to make the festival accessible. And there's a kind of political, social, political angle in that as well, that I think listening to music and sound that stretches our imaginations, that makes us think differently, has a social role. It makes us kind of more agile, more nimble to kind of think about change or maybe be ready for the unexpected, makes us challenge our own opinions, challenge our own biases and our own prejudices. I'm not saying like you listen to one experimental music concert and then the world has changed, but I think like this constant like set of inputs that are challenging or different is useful in society. So when you start from that point, then I think it's really important that as many people as possible get access to that kind of, I don't want to say transformative cultural experience, but like this kind of space of transgression or this, like to borrow a term from Chantal Mouffe, like this agonistic space, like that can set people into kind of different ways of thinking or just challenge them a little bit. So then, yeah, we want as many people to see that. And that shouldn't just be like men like me, like middle-aged white men with beards who like sitting in basements listening to weird music. It should be like everyone who likes to listen to something different. It should be everyone from across the community who wants to get involved and take on that political aspect of it as well. Then the way the whole festival is structured, then the way that we present ourselves becomes really important. So yes, to kind of be a place where all of the community can come together, where we can have discussions, where we can listen to complex ideas is super important to why we do the festival.
It says in your program leaflet that whether in the concert hall or on the dance floor, this is where our activism lies. You have been committed to a 50-50 gender equal lineup for a few years already. And this year it seems that you're furthering this commitment with the project Do Not Saying in collaboration with your current artist in residence, Jenny Moore. Can you tell me more about what this project is about and how it is reflected in this year's festival?
Sure. I think we realized that any move to kind of create a diversity initiative, if you hit your target, all you do is open up more questions for yourself, right? So like at that one point, 50-50 was this big target. But as soon as you start to dig into 50-50, you think, well, hang on, gender isn't a binary notion. So why are we setting ourselves a 50-50 target? What does that mean? So you get to that point, you're like, oh, right, okay, there's more to do. So the work is always ongoing and always needs to be done and always needs to be at the front of our minds. We're a really small organization. We have one full-time employee and then four part-time employees year-round, which is, you know, comparatively to other places where there's not arts funding, it's big for a festival. But, you know, we realized that we wanted to make structural changes, that we wanted to make big ideas happen. We wanted to try and take care of everybody, but that we needed to make long-term commitments to communities that we wanted to engage with, to think about the festival, not just within this five-day window when we do all the concerts. So we wanted also to have an artist-led project because we are an arts organization, right? So Doing Not Saying was an invitation to Jenny Moore, who's a musician and an artist and an activist based in London, who's been at the festival before, to kind of lead us through some ways of thinking and to help us think about ourselves and our organization and what, like, thinking about others, taking care about others, having intentional spaces can mean for an organization. So she started work with the organization a year ago, which was with me and Tina, my co-director, and then with the broader staff that we have, and that's broadened out into public workshops, but also working with our volunteers who come to the festival and help out, and also forming this feminist militia that exists now in Bergen. So it's been really like a flowering out of saying, like, let's not just have another panel discussion about gender diversity in classical music, or, you know, how do we make a safe space? Because if we just sit and do this talking game, nothing happens, right? And we've been talking for years. So the project was focused on what does it mean if you say we have a space that respects all bodies, what does that actually mean? What do you do to do that? And so that's been like the process. Yeah, so it's been... I think this comes down to the fact that we want to make a festival that has the most interesting sound and music from different perspectives happening now. Like, that never, ever goes away. But at the same time, we realize we live in a world that's massively unequal and that opportunities are not there for everybody in the same way. So we want to make a festival that engages with that. And I think if any arts institution isn't actively engaging with that idea, then effectively they're just propping up the status quo, which is massively unequal, it's often massively sexist, it's massively racist, right? So these are things that we have to look at and say to ourselves, yes, we are benefiting from all of these patriarchal, racist structures in society in the way that culture works, and we need to actively work against them.
Peter, one thing I found interesting about the festival program is how performances are followed by talks and lectures, with both the artists themselves as well as experts corresponding to the subject of the pieces. Say with Sweet Tooth by Elaine Michener, a musical theater piece looking at the history and impact of slavery, it is followed by a conversation on how music can relate to the history of slave trade, and along with several pieces on the climate crisis, such as the Lithuanian opera Son of the Sea, there are lectures on the subject of the climate crisis and how art can respond.
I think one of the ways that this art exists in the world is through ideas and through concepts. And I'm in a really privileged position. Often I get to talk to the artists about what they're going to do, about why they're doing it. I get to curate this program and I get to think about the ideas. And those conversations shouldn't just be for me. So I think we want to find that space where this music intersects with other ideas and other ways of thinking and this social, political kind of world, because none of this art is made in a vacuum and it all responds to something. So the conversation was, I think, a way of just kind of expanding what being at the festival means, and also shifting this hierarchy between ideas and performance and workshops, and just trying to create all of different kind of spaces for people to come together. And there's so much to say about so many of these performances. So yeah, Sweet Tooth, Elaine Michener's piece that draws on quite a personal history of family in the Caribbean, and then British history of the sugar trade and the trade of enslaved peoples from West Africa, this also then, you know, doing that in Norway, what does that mean, right? And then there's a whole bunch of research on Nordic colonialism and the fact that Norway was also taking part in the kind of trade of enslaved peoples in different ways, which isn't a history that's being talked about a lot here. So it's like, how do we make these performances not just one 45-minute thing that happens, which is amazing in itself, but also part of a bigger conversation? And if you have those conversations, where does that lead for your audience? One thing we try and do is encourage people to come to more than one thing, right? So the stuff doesn't clash mostly. So it's possible to spend a day with us and go to three or four things over an evening. And hopefully some of them have connections, some of them are kind of different shifts in mood. But then there's space in between where people can talk or have that conversation. And that's, I think, where the real interest is, right? That you go to a thing, you don't necessarily like it. It's totally fine not to like the stuff you see. We're not here to be like a popularity contest. We're here to present work that is challenging, that is intriguing, that makes you question yourself. And I think if you come out with pieces like, whoa, I don't know what that is, but I want to talk to this person next to me about it, then that's also as good a reaction as saying, that was the best thing I've ever seen.
There are many workshops on the program as well, such as yoga, swimming, boxing, many run by F Choir. Tell us more about these and how they contribute to the festival experience.
Sure. So F Choir is this choir that's come as part of Doing Not Saying project. And they, one of the things we wanted to do was have this kind of sharing of experiences and sharing of knowledge, and that's often a kind of an activist space, right? Is that you get people together with different life experiences but also different competencies and professional experiences, and you learn from each other. So the festival acts a little bit like that as well, that people can come to workshops, they can learn something. So that might be somebody who does kind of body-centered yoga that works around breathing in connection to how we breathe as bodies in choirs, right? It's a choir member who runs the yoga. But it might be a politics swap, or it might be a listening session, or it could be looking at hierarchical, like anti-hierarchical practices in choir rehearsal, like these kind of things, right? So then it's also about having lots of different modalities of engagement for people. So we all respond in different ways in different scenarios. So one of those ways is sitting on a seat in a dark room listening to something, right? But another thing is being social, being with people. Another thing is listening and being in conversation. Another thing is moving physically our bodies. And a lot of this kind of these ideas of centering, of doing, not saying, is not just being a passive thing, but being an active body and centering some of those feelings and ideas within our bodies through movement, through sound. So hopefully there is this kind of total mix of stuff that people can come to, and it's all connected in some way, and that they have this experience. And what's really nice is that after 5 days of doing this, you see people, and you're like, hey, you know, you were the person, and we were doing this bee dance together in that workshop with Jenny, and I cried, and it was really awkward, and now here we are on the dance floor together, and then we're going to be sat in this concert, and now we're probably eating together somewhere. Festival can be a way of imagining a way that we would like our society to be. And I think that's really important to remember. We have these 5 days together, right? People have their lives, you know. I have to do my stuff at home, you have to do your stuff. But we come together with open ears and with an idea that we're going to like experience some stuff that we've never heard before, we didn't know. And that's a really beautiful community space. It's a really beautiful kind of speculative space. So if we can inhabit the kind of the creativity and the beauty of those moments, but also think together and work together, then I think there's huge potential in these kind of special festival moments.
That was Borealis Festival Artistic Director Peter Meanwell talking to Monocle's Nora Hole. Do listen back to the festival at borealisfestival.no. And if you're interested in experimental music, you can listen into another of Peter's projects, Lake Junction, on BBC Radio 3. Now, Fernando, yet more evidence of how, especially in audio, it can be hands across the ocean and around the world. Even in straightened times, there's ways to find little pockets of inspiration, if you know where to look and listen.
The whole show was basically pockets of inspiration. That's a good show. I mean, we need that in this time, Tom.
We've never needed it more, Fernando. It has brightened my day to be here with you in Studio One of Midori House. Thanks for being the co-host of this edition 560 of the Monocle Weekly. We should thank the other people that made it happen.
Of course, our producer, Augustin Macellari, and our studio manager as well, Maylee Evans. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.